Okay, so this is going to be a little bit of a standalone Agata this year. I know we haven't finished introductions yet, and I'm going to leave that in my normal Agata slot. And then we'll go to sort of, you know, harder Agadot. But there is a short little line here in the first parak of Shvi'it that I think is part of a very important general discussion. And that is the following. Okay, if you look at the sources, just look at the Pesukim. So in Parashat Ha'azinu, the Torah tells us as follows: "Vayomer aleihem simu levavchem lechol dvarim asher anochi me'id bachem hayom asher titzavum et b'neichem lishmor la'asod kol divrei haTorah hazot." So Moshe instructs the Jewish people: take heart to all the words which I've warned you on this day. Tell your children so that they will keep the Torah. And then he says, "Ki lo davar reku mikem ki uchayichem." Because the Torah is not empty. It's not empty for you. And by keeping it, so your days will be lengthened in the land that you are now crossing over and stuff. Okay? Now, the Yerushalmi we're going to look at, which here I'd put from an earlier source in the Midrash Tanaim, addresses this pasuk. But here's the question I want to ask you, okay? When the Torah says, "Ki lo davar reku mikem," the Torah is not empty. There's an inherent problem with that pasuk. And that is, well, what would it mean for something to be empty? There's nothing in it. So now let me ask you a question. Okay, if I have an empty cup, right? And I ask you, is it empty? It's empty. And then Josh says, no, it's air. So why is Yonatan saying it's empty? Because it's empty of, or put it differently, it's empty of what it should have. But Josh is answering technically, right? Meaning if the question was, right? So if I was asking, like normally in the colloquial, is it empty? Yonatan would be right. But what if I was a scientist and I was asking you whether the cup is a vacuum and actually empty? Right? What would the answer to the question be? No. So when you say that something's empty, what is that? How can you, what do you need to do in order to say that something's empty? Yes, you need context. Or in other words, you need to have an assumption about what it should be full of. Right? Yeah. Now, what's the problem with Torah? Is if you say, "Ki lo davar reku mikem," it's not empty, then what is that assuming? What? Yeah, you know what it's supposed to have, right? What it's supposed to accomplish, what the words of Torah are supposed to accomplish, and whatever they're supposed to accomplish, they do. But what does this pasuk not tell you? Yeah, very good. So how do you go about figuring that out? Methodologically, right? You look at the pasuk and you say, aha, it's not empty of what it's supposed to be full with. Aha. Good. Now give me context. Now tell me what it's supposed to be full of, that it is indeed full of and not empty of. And we have what clue? Nothing. We have no idea, right? The pasuk tells you nothing. So this is the problem that the Yerushalmi will see is dealing with, but so is everybody else. So you tell me, and what I once argued about this pasuk and all the drasha on this pasuk is that there is no good answer to that question. There is no good answer to that question. The answer to that question reveals your preconceived notion about what Torah should be. But there is no question, but there's no way of getting to that, right? You can't prove it, right? You can't prove it, right? Meaning who's right, Josh or Yonatan, about whether the cup is empty? Yonatan, obviously, right? But that's because Yonatan assumes that the proper way that you should look at it is the way colloquially we're talking about it, right? He just assumes that's the right way to approach it. But what if I said, but I don't care about the way the average person approaches it? Oh, no. The fact that God compels you to is fine. But when you have this overarching statement, like the Torah is not empty, right? You need an idea of what it is it's supposed to accomplish that it is not empty of. So good. So tell me, what do you So help me. What do you think the Torah should have such that the Torah asserts very clearly it's not empty of that? What do you think the Torah should accomplish? What? Okay, good. What type of lesson?
How to live your life.
Okay, so we'll see that. We're good. So lessons, what type? But we'll see. Well, okay, before I do that even, right, if you look at number three, Rabbi Nebuchadnezzar gives you what I think is a way that sort of gets around this problem. Right, Rabbi Nebuchadnezzar says, "Ki lo davareku mikem, al derech hapshat lo tiva HaKadosh Baruch Hu davar betorah levatala." Right, he says, what does it mean that it's not rake? It's not empty. It means that nothing in it is for no reason. Right, everything God commanded for a reason. What reason? We have no idea. Then he doesn't tell you. He's saying this pasuk is just telling you that everything has a reason. What's the reason? We don't know. It's just not reasonless. Right? Correct. And therefore he says...
That implies that
it's something that we can understand. So that's the problem. Right? That Rabbi Nebuchadnezzar is saying, you love a rekumi, meaning it's not totally worthless. What it is, I don't know. Right? Targum Yonatan seems to also try to solve the problem, but a little bit more creatively, and he says, right, Targum Yonatan is not really Yonatan, I'll call it Yonatan, but really, okay, very quickly. Targum Onkelos is the standard Targum of Bavel, right? Which are, I didn't realize so many people would come, you have to make more copies or share. Or is the next one there? There's one right there, Moshe. What? So, there are other Targumim, right? Targumim are translations, but the Targumei Eretz Yisrael are not really translations. They also are midrashic, and they have all types of expansions, right, incorporated into the Pasuk by Pasuk translation. The only full manuscript we have was published only in the 20th century, which is either known as Targum Ktav Yad Romi, right, the Targum, which was found in the Roman manuscript because it was found in the Vatican. Sometimes it's referred to as Neophyti. I don't really know why it's called Neophyti. It's a very interesting Targum. One year I did Stein Mikra with Neophyti. Very interesting. With all the Targum Magyar, so it was very fun. But what you find in like the standard like red Mikra Gedolah, Targum Yonatan is not Targum Yonatan. Anavi, there is Targum Yonatan, Yonatan ben Uziel, the Tana. But he didn't, as far as we know, did not write a Targum on Chumash. The Gemara doesn't seem to know of it. It probably was that at some point it said Tuf Yud, right? Which is Targum Yerushalmi, and then someone thought it was Targum Yonatan. What? And just one second. The reason we know that it's probably not Targum Yerushalmi, even though it has a lot of traditions from Eretz Yisrael, is because some of it is clearly medieval. It's clearly medieval, right? So, for example, when it talks about the wives of Esav who married the daughters of Yishmael, right, it gives them names, like Fatima, right, which is clearly reading Islam, right, into, right, so clearly you're talking post, right, post-Muslim. So at least part of Targum Yonatan is much later, but okay. Targum Yonatan definitely reflects, a lot of it is from early Targum Eretz Yisrael, it just has later editions. So in academic language, it's called Pseudo-Jonathan, okay? Pseudo-Jonathan, what? Yes, but in Mikraot Gedolah it also has Targum Yonatan and some of them, and Targum Yerushalmi, which is in academic speak called fragment, the fragment Targum, because we don't have all of it. Nothing fancy there, right? We don't have all of it. But okay, Targum Yonatan, or Miyuchas LeYonatan, says, Arum leit pitgam rekam be'oraita, Elohein de'la'avrin alei. There is nothing vain or meaningless in the Torah unless those who transgress it. Meaning, if you treat it as meaningful, then it has a purpose. And if you don't keep the Torah, then you are treating it as having no purpose, right? So again, he's trying to sort of, right, both Rabbi Nebuchadnezzar and Targum Yonatan are not getting to the question of what is it supposed to have. They're just saying it has something, or if you keep it, it's meaningful. If you don't keep it, then you're missing out on meaning, right? But they're not getting to the question of what is it. But everyone else, pretty much in history, has tried to figure out, okay, well, what is it? Right? It's not empty, which means it's supposed to be full, but what is it full of? So Josh says lessons. What type of lessons? Right? You're making an assumption. You assume that the Torah... Now watch what Josh just did. Josh said, aha, the Torah is a book of lessons, which means to be empty would be to lack those lessons. So since I assume that the Torah is a book of lessons, then empty means empty of those lessons. But what type of lessons? That's very vague. And you're like, okay, and what? Okay, so here's the watch. According to Josh, what has he committed himself to? Josh says the Torah is about lessons. He didn't say what type of lessons. It's instructing you in how to live, which means that if there were a pasuk that didn't instruct you how to live, it would be an empty pasuk. And therefore, in order for the Torah not to be empty, what does it need to have at every turn? What does it need to have at every turn?
A lesson.
Kobe says, well, why is that? What if I have a pasuk that seems to teach no lesson of how I should live my life? Right? So according to Josh, that's a problem, because that pasuk seems to be empty. But Kobe says, it's not empty. Why? Because what does Kobe think the Torah is about? Ah, so he's a little bit, right? No, it's about transmitting God's will, and as long as the pasuk reveals God's will about something, you don't know. Ah, and you see why it's important? You see how this works? Right? This pasuk forces you to ask yourself, what do I think the Torah is supposed to be? Such that if it lacked it, it would be empty.
Well, have multiple meanings.
Okay, could be multiple things. I'm not saying there can't be a plurality of meanings, right? But you still got to ask. You could say, okay, it has to accomplish one of these three things, right? Right now, obviously, if I said, well, what I think the Torah should be is a jumble of letters, right? That's what I think the Torah should be. That's my theological approach. So then, kilo davarekum mikem. You're right, it's letters. Look at that, beautiful letters. I mean, it's just beautiful, right? So obviously, by definition, it wouldn't be empty, because it is what it's supposed to be, right? Now, the Shalah does the following. He says, listen, you know what the Torah is trying to tell you? Is you might have thought, and this is a very modern Western idea, you might have thought that what is the Torah supposed to teach you? How to be moral, how to have a good society, right? Because as we all know, in Western morality, as Jonathan Haidt has very extensively documented, one of the fundamental differences between traditional moral theories and modern moral theories is how many axes of value they have, right? Is that traditional ones included things within morality like holiness and authority and tradition and loyalty and things like that, which modern don't, right? It's care harm and things like that. Right? Everything else is not moral, it's something else, right? But let's say you're a modern Western person, and therefore you judge things in terms of morality, what we would call like bet adam l'chavero, you know, harm or whatever. So then the mishpatim are obviously not rake, right? Because they provide meaning on the axis which you judge meaning by which you judge meaning, okay? Right? But what about chukim? What about non-intelligible ritual laws? What would someone who is completely grounded only in modern Western morality, what would they say about a complete,
yeah,
right? Or in this word, it's empty. Right? It's empty. So, Shalah says, the Torah compares the statutes to the social laws. The message is just as there are easily appreciated reasons for the social legislation of Torah, so we must believe that the reasons underlying the chukim are equally good. They are not rake, empty, devoid of logic. Now, what does the Shalah come and say? He says, listen, you might write for him, he says, what should a law have? A rationale. What laws obviously have rationales? Mishpatim. So by that logic, anything which is just a chok, right, you might have thought, is rake. What's his answer? The pasuk is coming to tell you it has a rationale. Now, does he say what that rationale needs to be? No, because for the Shalah, what does it mean for something to be empty? To lack any reason. What does it mean for something to not be empty? To have some reason. Correct. The Shalah is obviously not writing directly. But my point is, right? Right, but the Shalah is willing to be a little bit more expansive. What does the Shalah say? Does the Shalah tell you what's supposed to be in the Torah? No. What does he say? The Torah is supposed to include things that have reasons. So the only thing that would mean for it to be empty is to lack a reason. And therefore, all it's coming to tell you is that even the laws that you don't understand have reasons, and therefore they're not rake. But Kobe says that's not enough. That's not enough to get him to a modern point, because what would right? What would a modern thinker be looking for? Right? Moral laws, right? And therefore, anything that doesn't have moral laws, they would say, is lacking, right? So now you come to the Torah, and certain things might not have moral laws. So then you have two choices, which are either to find a moral rationale even behind what's not obviously moral, or to define part of the Torah as rake, right, as empty, right? Right? You would have two options at that moment. You could either be very creative and figure out how seemingly non-moral laws, not immoral laws, but amoral laws, right? Laws that are just about ritual, let's say, they're not moral in the modern sense, right? Are in fact moral, or you would have to redefine, right? You have three possibilities. Reject the Torah, right? Reject the Torah, explain why it's moral, or come up with a plurality of values.
And then it gets worse if the amoral law moral.
That's for sure true. Now, I will point out, the exact same methodology we're going to use here can be used on the Mishnah, right? The Mishnah says, turn over the Torah, because everything's in it. What's the problem with saying everything's in it?
The things that aren't in it.
Well, the things that are not in it. So then you got to figure out, well, everything means everything, right? Right? It's like, for those of you who read Harry Potter, right? Like, Bertie bought every flavor beans, right? And I mean every flavor. Okay, but it still only has different flavors. It doesn't have everything. It just has every flavor, right? Jelly bean, right? So the Torah has everything in it. What does it have? Well, it has everything you think it should have, right? Right? It's not like if you include in it cars, well, you don't open the Torah and a car comes out, right? It just doesn't have that because you didn't think it would, right? It's not like, hafosma, keep turning your Gemara over. Eventually a car will fall out of it, right? That's not what it meant because that wasn't what it was supposed to be. It's full of whatever it's supposed to be full of, right? So if you thought it was about morality, so either you're going to be disappointed, right? Or you're going to be forced to come up with a plurality of values, or you're going to have to explain why everything's moral. Now,
if something's empty, it has nothing in it. So once the Torah has something in it, there could be other things.
But that's the interesting thing, is no, because the cup, Yonatan still says the cup is empty even though it has air in it. Why? Because that's not what it's supposed to have. Right? It's not supposed to only have air. It's supposed to have a liquid. If it doesn't have a liquid, then it's empty. But that's only
if you think that
counts. Right? If Yonatan is saying what I mean by full and empty is liquid, then it doesn't matter that there's air in it.
Yeah, but if the cup has a quarter cup of water, it's not completely full, but it has some water in it.
Fine.
Nobody said that nobody's going to empty.
Correct.
So when some of the things...
But only if you think... So Josh says, but wait a second, this assumes Kilo Davarei Kumikem is going on the totality of the Torah. I made a move, right? And I said Kilo Davarei Kumikem means there is nothing in it. Now, why am I getting there? Good. I was cheating because this is where we're going to get to the Yerushalmi. Is that, right, Chazal go much farther because Josh says you can just solve the problem. You can solve the problem by saying Kilo Davarei Kumikem means the Torah is not empty. It doesn't mean that every single pasuk has meaning, right? Very good. Right, so I was cheating a little bit, right? As we'll see, right, this is the assumption that Chazal are going to deny, right, is the possibility that Kilo Davarei Kumikem is on the totality of Torah. They're going to deny that could be what it means. But before we get to Chazal, okay, the Rambam, yeah.
Not the whole thing, that there's some words that are empty, meaning you just can't understand.
Okay, so you want me to run, so fine, I'll jump to it, and this is why I got to it. Okay, we'll come back. Why am I assuming it this way? Because Chazal make a move, which as Josh notes, is not obvious. And that is, and you can look at it in the Yerushalmi if you want, you can look at the Midrash Tanayim, but in the Yerushalmi, right, you get it on Hey Amud Bet, where you get as follows. The Gemara says, V'asya ki demar Rav Mana. Now we'll see that in context, it might mean something else in the Yerushalmi as well. But at the bottom of Hey Amud Bet, it says, Ki lo davar reiku mikem, v'im reiku mikem. The Torah is not empty. And if it is empty, it is from you. Right? That's a very clever read, right? Ki lo davar reiku mikem. Which how does he read it? If it is reik, that's your fault. The Torah is not the empty one, it's you. Mikem. It's your failure to understand it. Right? Vilama, she'ein atem yigein bo. Kihi chayechem, because you aren't putting enough effort. Eimatai chayechem, when is it your life? Vishatratem yigainbo. Now, how do I know that this refers to every single line and every single pasuk and every single everything? So you go back just one line in the Yerushalmi is talking about a single halacha. Shekach haita halacha biyadam shechichu ba'amdu ashniyim v'yiskimu al dar rishonim. It was a single halacha, which was passed on halacha Moshe Sinai, then was forgotten, and then was remembered. Lamedcha shekol davar shebeidin nodin nasham alav tovol itkayim biyadam kimash ne'emar Moshe Sinai. It means that any single detail that you are moser nefesh on will last. It's clear. What's it talking about? It's not talking about halacha, the Torah as a whole. What's it talking about? Right? Every single detail. Now, you could argue that it goes even farther than that. And this is something that James Kugel and Yaakov Ellman both introduced independently as follows. And they argue that the fundamental assumption of Chazal is what's called omnisignificance. So Kugel in 10 translates as follows. Omnisignificance constitutes the basic assumption underlying all of rabbinic exegesis, that the slightest details of the biblical text have a meaning that is both comprehensible and significant. Nothing in the Bible ought to be explained as a product of chance or, for that matter, as an emphatic or rhetorical form or anything similar, nor ought its reason to be assigned to the realm of divine unknowable. Every detail is put there to teach something new and important and is capable of being discovered by careful analysis. Right, so Kugel says, you want to understand Chazal, you need to understand, as Yaakov Ellman will point out, this line. Why? Because he says, think about it. Is it fair to say that Chazal read it the way Josh does? Well, there's some mitzvot, so not everything means meaning. No, obviously not. Why is that? How do I know that's not how Chazal read it? Because how many halachos does Chazal derive from an extra vav? Or an extra yud? Or a gzera shave? Right? The fact that two halachos use the same word. Right? How many? A lot. The answer is a lot, right? Yes, but every vav and every yud, right? Every so often they have a machloket of whether you're allowed to use from an et, right? But there are positions that every et, every hey, every vav, every yud, every mali, every chaser, right? Every zeri shava has a meaning, right? So Kugel argues that, you know how Chazal understood Torah? That every possible meaning that exists, or resonance, really, right? What's resonance? Who's a musician here? Good. So what is resonance? It's not just the vibration. Right. Well, why is it that a chord sounds the way it does? Because every note has, right, main vibrations and main notes that it makes and subnotes. And when you, right, and when you play a chord, all those resonances get brought out because they exist. They're just hard to hear unless, right, you tap into it.
Right.
Right? By, right? Right? And then they work off of each other, and it creates that, right, that sound. That's basically the way Chazal read Torah, right? It's not just the plain meaning, the main meaning, which is the main note, but every vav and every yod and gzera shava, right, adds a level of meaning beyond the simple meaning of the pasuk, because the connection to another pasuk adds another layer that, when played together, has yet more, right, sound, right? That's how they read it, right? So for Chazal, it seems like, what does reik mean? What would it mean for something to be reik? For any letter, any resonance to not be utilized would be for it to be empty. Every single yud, vav, zeresh, everything, right? Every use of every word, every s, every, right? And so what is the meaning they're looking for? Well, they clearly have a plurality. They're not just plural, not just hidden. Their assumption is that everything must have something, instruction, right? Whether it be theological, legal, doesn't matter, right? And therefore, for any letter to not have a meaning is for it to be empty of its purpose, which is to teach, well, something, because also they have a plurality, right? Or if you look in number 13, how Yaakov Ellman puts it, he says, look, having claimed such profundity for all of Scripture, the rabbinic program may be expected to deliver on its promise. Right? Meaning, once you do that, right, now you should go through. Once you claim that it's a fault, if you can't find meaning in every yud, what's the problem? If you don't go and find meaning in every yud, then what have you done? Correct. But the problem is, did Chazal go through every single yud and every single f and every single vav and every... No. right? Which means that they claim this is what it means for something to have meaning, which is for every letter to have meaning, right? Every crown to have meaning, right? Chazal says explicitly, right? Every kiva would learn halachot from every crown. It's clear that what they think for something to be empty is for, not for it to be empty in its totality, but for any of it to not do something, right? Problem is they didn't do it. What Elman points out is that in the 19th and 20th century, they did, right? The Mefarshim started taking it up, pasuk by pasuk, the Malbim, the Siv, Meshech Chachmar, Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin, Ben of Jacob, right? He says, for reasons having to do with the problematics of the concept itself and certain historical developments, that promise was never fulfilled. Omni significance remains an ideal which was never actually realized. Not every feature of Scripture was interpreted by the rabbis either halakhically or agadically. Our collections of Midrashim hardly constitute a comprehensive omnisignificant corpus. Not only do they fail to deal with many verses and even whole biblical chapters, but features which are considered significant, legally or morally, in one context are ignored in another. And even when truly omnisignificant commentaries are attempted, chiefly in response to the challenges of the 19th century, many passages remain relatively untouched, even in the Pentateuch. Moreover, by insisting on the primacy of halachic and theological ethical modes of interpretation over all others, including historical and aesthetic, the doctrine of omnisignificance sharpened the problem even while providing some methods to overcome it. But now he notes the problem, which is you could always have said, well, one of the things that the Torah should have is beauty. It's aesthetic beauty. It should be good literature. Right? If you believe that one of the things that are valuable in life is beauty, then you could always say the Torah isn't empty because it sounds beautiful. The fact that Chazal never say, oh, that hay is just beautiful, right? It just sounds better. What are they implicitly telling you? That aesthetics don't count. Right? Then meaning is pluralism, right? There's a plurality of meanings, but aesthetics don't count. Right? Literary, right? And like the Malbim, someone told me they were learning Tehillim. I don't know, Shimon was on Shabbat, right? But, right, some of the Mefarshim, as you know, some of the Pashtunim are happy to say, Kefel HaMilim, Davar HaMilim Shono, that if you have two halves of a verse in Tehillim that sound like the same, they'll say, it's just poetic, it's repeating it poetically, right? And people like Rashi or the Malbim, will they ever do that? No, they'll always explain the nuanced difference. Why? Because the Pashtunim think that beauty is meaningful, and therefore, if I say, the pasuk is repeating itself to be poetic, that is legitimate because aesthetic beauty counts, right? But if you don't think aesthetic beauty counts, only moral or legal or theological meaning counts, then you have to explain that theologic, right? Because if you believe, A, that you need omnisignificance, which means every letter must be meaningful, and B, beauty doesn't count as meaning, then you have to go back to what is otherwise simply a beautiful, right, poetic expression and find meaning that counts, right? And that's what the Malbim tries to do, right? But that makes several assumptions. First of all, that, as Josh notes, kilo davar eikum mikem applies to every letter, every word, and not just the Torah as a whole. And B, that aesthetic beauty doesn't count, right? If you thought either that the Torah has to have meaning in its totality, but not necessarily every word, or you thought that aesthetic beauty is considered something, then having aesthetic beauty would be enough to explain itself. Correct, but people like the Malbim will explain every word, right? And they'll explain why we repeat things and the slight nuances in words. They won't just say, oh, it's beautiful, right? They won't suffice with that. Now, to show you how circular this can be sometimes, if I told you, this word has legal meaning and all that, but it doesn't, I don't learn something from its gematria. How many of you would be bothered by that? I'm asking you. I'm not bothered by it. Why am I not bothered by it? Why are you not bothered by it? What? It has meaning, and I don't think that the meaning it should have is numeric meaning. Who cares? Right? But what if you're someone who is obsessed with hidden meaning in numbers, then what are you going to do? What? Very good, like the Balaturim, good. Then what are you going to look, what are you going to believe that any pasuk that doesn't also have a gematria and an extra meaning is missing meaning that it could have? Watch this unbelievable, well this really is, circular logic by Reb Chaim Paltiel is run by a Tosfos in 11. Kilo davar reku mikem. Bigematria, gematriot. The gematria of kilo davar reku mikem is gematriot. Right? Now that is the most single, most circular drasha I have ever seen in my entire life. Right? Which is, aha! What it means for nothing to be empty is that it also has numeric meaning. How do I know? How do I prove it? Because the gematria of the pasuk that says that nothing is empty of meaning is gematria. Aha! Very good. I walk in by the assumption that all meaning should also include built-in meaning hidden into the numbers, and I will prove it using the methodology that I assume. Yes, he does. And that is about as, right? But that only proves my point, that how do you know what meaning to look for? Right? Whatever you thought it should have, because you'll find it. Right? The tour adds it even. Right? Watch. And the tour does the same thing, because at least Chaim Paltiel limits himself to meaning being in the numbers. But as I said, you could also think that where should meaning be? In the crowns. Watch what the tour does. Thank you, Kobe. Tadien al akuf. The kuf has an extra crown. Why? Lo marsha filu al atagin shal Torah tilim tilim shal alachot. There's an extra crown on the word rake to tell you that the crown should also be used to derive meaning. Again, it's a bit circular, but that's exactly my point. Is this whole drasha is circular by definition, right? When you say something that isn't empty, the only way to figure out whether it's not empty is to figure out what it should have been full of. Right?
If I know the crown doesn't have meaning, why wouldn't you do something with that meaning?
What? I don't know, but he did it, right? It's clear what he's doing methodologically, right? Now, I gave you some others, just quickly, because I do need to run to get Mincha, because my wife has to go to a wedding later, so I do have to run. But if, for example, other possibilities. The Rambam, in general, thinks that in addition to moral and theological things, the Rambam thinks one of the values of Torah is historical, because, right, the Rambam thinks that some of the Torah is fighting the Abu Zara in the past, right? And therefore, look, if you look at 5, that's what the Rambam says. In addition to the legislative contents, the Bible includes historical information, right? And this is the translator's note on it. And Maimonides, in briefly reviewing the biblical narrative, shows these are likewise intended to improve man's physical, moral, intellectual condition. It's not vain thing for you, and when it proves vain to anyone, it is his own fault. Right, the Rambam quotes it, but the Rambam has a plurality of values. And therefore, does the Rambam need to look for direct lessons? No, but he can look for historical lessons because he thinks that's valuable. Right? Okay, you know what? Because I do need to get the Mincha, I'm going to leave you with this. Right? You can see I gave you a few other perushim here. The Panim Yafo, the Hemek Davar, Al-Sheikh. Right? But methodologically, what I want you to walk away with is as follows. This is true of drasha, but it's true of psukim in general. When you have a pasuk like this, right, where something asserts it has value, right, we all have preconceived notions of what that value should be. But you can't say something has value unless you assume what would make something valuable. Right now, obviously, it's not in a vacuum. You could say, well, the Torah is meaningful, and let me read the rest of the Torah, and it'll give me some indication of what I should be looking for. Right? But as you see here, everyone at some level, what drives the way they interpret, including the Gemara here, is their assumption of what they should be looking for. Right? It's not empty of that which I should be looking for, but you need to know what you're looking for in order to figure out whether it's empty. Right? And that's really the challenge here. Right? Right? The challenge here is to realize that. Right? That figuring out what you're looking for in every pasuk can only happen if you have an assumption of what it is you, right, what it is should be there. Right, if all you think it should do is teach lessons, but beauty for you matters, right, then not every pasuk needs to have a moral lesson if it sounds beautiful. Because aesthetic, right, if you don't value aesthetics, then that's not an answer. Right? And that, as I said, is machlokes between the Pashtanim and other people who don't accept, right, poetic repetitions. Right? But as you'll see, if you go through the other mefarshim here, right, they'll talk about theological lessons, right, because obviously theology is important to you, right, then it will be there. Look through the Mepharshim, you'll see that it follows this, but I'll leave you with that for now. And again, this is the type of thing you have to do when you're understanding the Torah, when you're understanding drasha, right? This is a one-liner in the Agadata in Shviit, but as you see from Elman and Kugel, right, they're building entire, right, methodological assumptions about the Torah and ways of reading the Torah based on how it reads this one line, right? Okay, we'll stop there.